Well, you know my name already, but my name is Glenn Block. I'm a program manager on the WCF team, and I'm here to talk to you about building the next generation of applications for the web. We've seen a lot of trends over the last couple of years. We've seen this move from just building websites where a human being is accessing the information through a browser to web APIs. So if you look at that slide here, you see services like a lot of social services like Groupon, LinkedIn, Twitter, Yelp. And you see on the right, the parallel to that, almost you could say the sister, is an API. And that API allows mashups and other things to be able to consume that the capabilities that the site is providing, but use their own type of representation, which may not even be a browser. I might have a Silverlight application, for example, if I was building on the Microsoft stack that wants to consume the Yelp API. As a matter of fact, if we go on the Windows phone, we can see that that's actually happening. I might have an iOS application, which is native. I want to make all that information available to all these different clients, and web APIs provide a way to do that. So when we say web API, what we mean by that is exposing capabilities over the web from a functional standpoint, exposing programmatic access to those capabilities as opposed to just being rendered through a browser. Now, I really like that because of the fact that we have this richness of being able to really broadcast that message to the widest number of folks. That allows me to express my discontent and to get it to all the different devices simultaneously. And this was actually when I was at my mix talk. I was not too happy with the internet, so I was able to broadcast that to thousands and thousands of people. That made me feel good. Didn't help the internet speed up, though. But we've also seen, aside from social sites, other types of APIs emerging. Companies are taking their business functionality and exposing that. And it could be search-type services like Bing or Google. But then we have other companies like Comcast and Best Buy that are looking, you know, Comcast has delivered a solution over HTTP, a web-based solution for communicating with their cable boxes. And they've used the web to do that. Why? Why have they used the web to do that? Why wouldn't they just use something like sockets? Anybody have an idea? Don't all raise your hands at once. The reasoning is because the web offers a lot of guarantees. The web infrastructure was designed to do a lot of work for you, to provide great scale, great evolvability. But in order to leverage that, in order for the web to be a friend for you, you've got to be a friend to it. You've got to follow certain types of rules, things that were outlined in the HTTP spec, which we'll talk about in a minute. We've also seen this huge influx of devices. The PC is no longer the primary way I consume my functionality. I consume my services, the things that I work with. I may have an iPad with me, or I may have a Windows phone, or another type of device, an Android device, whatever it is. The reality is that if the service that I'm trying to consume is not going to meet me and work with my device, I may not use it. And that's a lost opportunity for companies that are delivering their functionality. So playing well with the web really means you get broader reach, broader access to customers, and you get to adopt to their types of lifestyles. For example, when I use my Windows phone, I want to use the Yelp app. It's right there for me. It's there for me when I'm on my PC. It's there for me when I'm with my device. And we've also seen this move towards the cloud. More and more companies are taking their capabilities and they're moving them off-premise. It's no longer about server-to-server communication behind the firewall. It's really moving stuff out to the cloud and allowing the maximum number of consumers to access those capabilities. SOAP's not really going to help you there. Because if I'm on my device that all it has is an HTML browser, then it's not going to know how to tunnel that information over SOAP, which is a proprietary protocol. But aside from that, is the fact that the web is not going to help me in the ways that it can if I take more advantage of HTTP. Everything in SOAP is tunneled over a single protocol, over POST. There's lots of caching infrastructure of the web that will help you build more scalable applications. and it will opt in. Servers will opt in to help you. But in order to do that, you can't be going over post. You've got to be going over get. So these are all the reasons, all the motivators we've seen for why we see this growth in these web APIs. And at the heart of it, what's common, the common thread between all of this is HTTP, the transfer protocol that the web was built on. And if you look here in the spec, HTTP 1.1 back in like 1990, it's not new. HTTP has been there for a long time. But for a long time, it was really something that servers were just communicating with, like web servers, or your browser was taking care of it. You didn't really have to worry about it. Now that we're starting to be more explicit, HTTP becomes a lot more important, having that type of control and being able to work with it. And I'll show you a bunch of different demos to illustrate why that's important. So every single one of these services that are out there, like Yelp, they're going to be accessible through a URI. Well, in order to be able to provide those type of capabilities, I need something. I need something on the server, some type of framework, something that's going to help me to be able to deliver things in ways that can be consumed by all these different devices. And for that, we are building WCF Web API. We want to offer a first-class experience for folks that want to expose their application capabilities over the web to a maximum number of devices beyond just browsers. And it could be even machines that are talking to each other directly. It could be servers that are actually communicating and integrating, the kinds of things that we thought back 10 years ago would only happen through SOAP. But now we see that the tide is shifting and more folks are looking to go directly to using things over, exposing their capabilities over HTTP. So over the next hour, what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at the web API. We're going to do a lot of coding. And we're going to explore the capabilities and the experience that it's offering. And we'll talk about the different types of scenarios that it's enabling. One of the things I want you to think about is there's a couple of different themes that we're thinking about as we're building this out. And one is simplicity. We want it to be really easy to get going and do the kinds of things that are most common without the framework getting in your way. So I've got a wager for you guys. I want you to call me out there at the end of this session. If you feel like what we're showing is not actually meeting that bar of making things simpler, we want to hear about it. So what we're going to do as far as our first sample that we're going to build is we're going to take a scenario of a contact management application. As a matter of fact, I'll show you what that looks like. So here I have a front end to a contact management application. You might say, well, the front end is the application. No, it's not actually the application. The application is all the back end capabilities. And in this case, I'm consuming that through a browser. I'm using jQuery on the front end. How many people here are actually using jQuery? jQuery is a great new web framework. I mean, you're almost like left in the dust if you're not using it because it offers so much richness out of the box, and it moves a lot of the logic to the client. So what we're seeing here is that my contact management application is accessible through jQuery, but it's also accessible to other types of devices, and we'll get into that. But this is the scenario. So my contact management app allows me to add contacts, remove contacts. For example, you can see here that I can go and remove myself. I can add somebody else, like my friend Jan Ogelmeisen, and I can say add. And we can see that that contact gets added. But I can also access this information in another way. I can take that URI and go into my Fiddler request builder. And HTTP allows me to utilize what are called accept headers, and it does this thing called content negotiation. This is part of the HTTP spec. It allows different clients to say, here's the kind of representation that I would like. So in this case, I'm going to just say application slash XML. Execute. And we see I get back a result that's XML. I can also take that same request, and now I'll change it to application slash JSON. Because when I'm in my jQuery world, I'm probably not dealing that much with XML. I'm probably more interested in returning things in JSON. Why? Because the browser understands JSON very well, and it can transform it into JavaScript objects. Okay, so that gives a bit of context here, where we've now seen a site that is being accessible from a front end, but it's also accessible to other types of devices that might need other formats. So how do you build that? So what we're going to do is we're going to create a brand new project. And it's going to be an ASP.NET application, an empty ASP.NET application. One of the things we've heard in the past is, hey, I work with ASP.NET. I've already got pages and other kinds of things in ASP.NET. And it would be nice if I could just integrate right in with ASP.NET and not have to go through some other type of model. So one of the things we've been working on in Web API is making that experience really nice. How many people here saw the keynote? One of the things that Scott showed in the keynote was NuGet. And NuGet is a great package manager that makes it easy to get going. And we're embracing that in Web API. So the first thing we're going to do after we create our empty web app, which we will call Contact Manager, actually, I can delete a lot of that stuff. Let's delete that. Sorry about that. One second. Let's try that again. What we want is ASP.NET empty web application. That's what we want. Okay. Let's try that again. Okay. So what I've done is I've just laid down an empty web app. There's nothing there other than just a standard ASP.NET site with an empty web config. Well, there's a few things in the web config. So now I want to get started with Web API. So what NuGet offers that's really nice is I can go to this package manager here, go online, as long as my network connection is working, I will get back a list of packages. And we've actually recently published a set of packages for our Web API. So if you search for Web API, you'll get back a bunch of different packages. If you choose Web API All, you'll get all the other packages installed. So I'm going to click Install now, and what that's going to do is it's going to go download all the binaries that are necessary, and there's not that many of them. It's going to hook up my project so I'm ready to go. Now, the nice thing that I really like about NuGet is I wasn't forced to choose a particular template. I could have chosen any template. I could have chosen not using an empty site. I wanted to use an empty site. So NuGet got me going really, really quickly. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to have to deal with contacts. So I'm going to cut and paste a little bit of code here, and I'll show you what is there so you know it's not sneaking anything in. I'm going to grab just some definitions that give me the contact itself and a repository. So I'm going to go and paste that into my Visual Studio. And just to show you what's there, I just have a simple contact, which is just a POCO. Right, nothing special. That's going to be my model. Nope. And then what I have is a contact repository. And that's just using some dummy data right now. But later on, if I wanted to, I could hook that up to a database. That's going to offer up my contacts. And now what I need to do is find a way to get those contacts exposed over the web, over HTTP. So the way I do that is I'm going to create a resource, which is just a class. Everything that is exposing itself over HTTP, a URI or a URL, is just a pointer to a resource. So resource is a very general purpose term. Don't think it's anything that has... The main thing that defines a resource is the fact that it's available over HTTP. So I'm going to define my contacts resource. And the idea here is I'm going to want to make it so that a consumer can get back contacts or can post contacts. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to annotate this with a service contract. That's the way that we tell WCF that, hey, I want to expose this thing over HTTP. And then I'm going to write a method that returns a list of contact. It's going to be a get method. And what it's going to do is I'm also going to have to new up a repository, because I have my contact repository that I showed you. I'm just going to set that. We'll come back to that later. And now I'm just going to go to the repository and do a get all. Now, I need to tell WCF, because of the fact that this is going to be exposed over HTTP, with HTTP I have methods. I have put, get, post, delete, etc. So I'm going to use the web get attribute, and I'm going to tell WCF that I'm not going to specify for it, I'm not going to give it any other information in terms of what the URI is, because with web API we actually integrate with ASP.NET routing. And I'm going to show you how that works in a second. So I'm done here. I've created my resource. My resource is going to return my contact information. Now I'm going to hop over and create a global ASAX. So we can register our routes. Okay. Let's delete this excess information here. Route table dot routes dot. So what we've done is we've introduced a new extension method called map service route. And what I do with map service route is I'm going to give it my contacts resource, and I'm going to specify the URI. Great. So once I've done that, that's all I should have to do. I should be able to now run this application. And if I go to contacts, we see that I get it back in XML. So out of the box, just by registering my resource, it supports XML. That's not all it supports, though. If we jump back to Fiddler, go back to my request builder, I used the wrong URI. Let's do that. Okay, so that should work. Click execute. And you can see that I got JSON. So out of the box, I got XML, JSON, didn't have to really do anything special. So if I can get JSON, then that means I can now go and take my jQuery UI and throw it on top. So let's do that. So I'm just going to do some more cutting and pasting here. I'm going to paste my scripts, take my scripts folder, my default web page and my main CSS. And I'm just going to paste that in. What is it doing? Did not want to do that. Okay. So if we look at our default HTML page, this is just static HTML that's using jQuery to retrieve some information. Great. Let's see what happens when we run it. There we go. So we were able to create our resource. We threw a jQuery front end on. Because of the fact that the server understood how to return JSON when required from the browser and how to do that content negotiation thing, there you go. We were able to get going very, very quickly without having to write a lot of code. Do you guys agree? Okay. Now, the one thing about browsers and jQuery is they don't only deal with XML and JSON. There's another very common format that browsers support. It's called form URL encoding. Every time I post from the browser, it's going to do a form URL encoded post unless I tell my form to use the query string and to do a get. Which if I want to leverage the benefits of the web and caching, I should only do that if I'm actually not modifying the state on the server, because that tells the caching servers, hey, this response is cacheable. If other people come and ask for it, they can get it. But back to form URL encoding. You could go to any phone that's out there that supports a web browser, even if it doesn't support a rich browser experience with JavaScript, it's going to understand form URL encoding. So it's a very, very important format for you to support if you're going to be surfacing things over the web. Well, with Web API, we also support form URL encoding out of the box without you having to do anything. And that's going to allow us to send contacts from the browser directly to our Web API. We don't have to have a page or anything else in front of it. We can literally just send that information back to that Web API using form URL encoding. So let's see how that works. Now, in order for that to work, I have to go back to my contact resource. Because my contact resource currently only allows me to do a get. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to create another method called post. And that post is going to accept a contact. And what it's going to do is it's going to go to the repository, do a post. So now what I need to do is, in Web API, we have a Web Invoke attribute. And the Web Invoke attribute allows me to specify my method and a optional URI template if I want to tweak how the URI is going to look, which I don't want to do right now. So what I'm going to do is specify that the method equals post. So once I've done that, if everything is working correctly, and it's not because it's not compiling, let's see. Ah, it needs to return the contact as well. So if I now go and add another name, I'll add my old buddy Brad Abrams, who's living the life up at Google these days, and I click add, we can see that I hit my breakpoint, and the post succeeded. But I mentioned the fact that when I was doing this, this is actually using this form URL encoding thing, which is different than XML and JSON. And there's a reason that's really important, because playing well on the web means you have to have really rich support for the different types of formats that are prevalent and accepted in the web. So I'm going to go add another name. This one's going to be Randall, one of the developers on our team who worked on the web API. And I'm going to click Add after I start capturing. And if we go back, you'll notice, that's the return type. Let's see, where is the... You can see here, if we zoom in, it says application form URL encoded. So here I've got my web API understanding three different media types without me having to do anything, supporting consumption through browser scenarios as well as consumption for other types of devices or other types of applications that may work with XML as an example. Okay, well, that's pretty cool. But one of the things about HTTP is that it's really rich. There are things like status codes. And when I return those status codes, a consumer of HTTP knows how to handle the response that I'm sending back. For example, when I do this post, what I really want to do is return a status code of a 201 or a 202, depending on what it is that I'm doing. Because there's different semantics implied to the client depending on which one I return. 201 means a resource was created. 202 means accepted, the resource will be created in the future. And there are many different clients out there that actually care about this information. That's why it's there as part of the HTTP spec. But I also have other things I need to access, like headers. E-tags are a way for me to embed an identifier that caching servers can use and that allows clients to ask for a cached version of something where instead of the entire representation having to get returned, the server that is receiving just gets an e-tag, which is an identifier, and looks it up and says that e-tag is still valid. So then it just returns a status code that says not modified. And that tells the client, I can just use what's in my cache. Well, if you think about how big the web is, that provides tremendous benefit. But the question is, if I'm working with all these objects here, how do I get access to that? So one of the tenets of the work we're doing in Web API is everything that the HTTP spec says you should be able to do, you can do, but still allowing you to do it in a way that is simple, and yes, even testable. And we'll see how right now. So here, when I do this post, what I want to do is say, return a contact, but also return a status code of 201. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to take this contact and I'm going to wrap it in a new type that we have called HTTP response message. What that's doing is saying, hey, I want to return a contact. I want that flexibility of being able to return an object because that's comfortable for me. I like IntelliSense, everything else. But I also want to mess with the response or the request. I might want to pull some information out or put some information in. And in this case, what I want to do is set the status code. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to create a new HTTP response message of T of contact. And once I've done that, I now get access to things like setting the status code. So I'm going to set the status code to created. If we now run this, because I didn't return it. Okay. Contact does not contain a constructor. It takes 0. Because I didn't pass the instance. So what happened here is I tried to create the response message. The response message of T is expecting the actual instance that's going to get returned, in this case, which is my contact that was passed in. So I'm going to put contact there. And then I'm going to return my response. And when we run, and we go in post, well, I'll put my wife now. She's not a developer, but I'll throw her in anyway. I'm sure she'll be pleased. Did that go through? Ooh, what happened there? Oh, it went through, but it's not. Oh, start capturing. Thank you. Let's try that one more time. Yeah, that's annoying that it doesn't actually remember those settings. Okay, but if the key thing to look at here is now we got our 201. So I was able to work with HTTP the way that I wanted to. That's a very simple example. Let's try another example that would be a little bit more sophisticated. Caching. So I'm returning this status code of created, but HTTP also allows me to do things like using my headers, I can set caching information, like what's the max, you know, what is allowable related to caching. Can servers cache this? Can clients cache this? Etc. Must they revalidate every single time? And I can set things like max age and create a time span that says 30 seconds. Now if I run this again, and I go and post that contact. I have to set cache control. Okay, wrong header. Let's try a different one. Let's see. So the first thing you can see here is that these are strongly typed headers. So when you work with HTTP response message or request message FT, we're giving you what you use managed code for, that ability to get a nice statically typed IntelliSense-driven experience for working with HTTP rather than just a dictionary. Okay, what I'm actually going to do is I have a little snippet for this one. I'm going to delete that. Yeah, okay. Okay, in this case, I didn't do caching, I set the location, which is another thing that you should do whenever you're posting content. You should return a location header. And so if we run that, do the redundant start capturing. And I click add, and I scroll down, I should see my location header there in my response headers. Where is it? Oh, why did that do 401? That must be the wrong one. Let's look at that again. Yeah, there we go. There's location right there. So I was able to set the location. What else can I do? So that's just showing me that ability to have fidelity of working with HTTP. And as I mentioned, I can also do the same thing on the request side. I can change my incoming post to give me an HTTP request of contact. And if I do that, HTTP request message, then I can also access headers, et cetera, on the request side. So I get full access request or response. Okay, interesting. So that's just the bare basics of getting going. Now, one of the things we heard a lot of feedback about in WCF was folks that want to do test-driven development. The first thing you'll notice here is that I'm not having to call any static APIs. That means if I want to do a unit test, in my unit tests, I can actually work with these request and response messages. And then I can write unit tests that validate that things like that location header are actually getting returned, and I don't need to actually pull in all of WCF to be able to do that. Another thing we heard feedback on was folks really like working with IOC containers. Does anyone here use IOC container? Raise your hands. Bunch of you? Cool. Folks that use IOC really love IOC. So the question is, if I want to use an IOC container here, can I? And the answer is yes. We have to do a little bit of work, but it's not a lot of work. So what we're going to do here is we're going to take this iContact repository and we're going to move it to be a constructor parameter instead of it being newed up directly. And then I'm going to say this.repository equals repository. Now, the next thing I have to do is pull in my IOC. Now, one of the things that Scott Hanselman talked about in his keynote was about having flexibility of being able to work with all the great stuff that the community does, not being stuck with having to just use what Microsoft prescribes. And in the case of IOC containers, for anybody who uses them, they know that there's a ton that are out there. My personal favorite is actually AutoFac, which may be a little known secret. So I'm actually going to use AutoFac, and I'm going to take advantage of what Scott was talking about with the building blocks to use NuGet. So I'm going to go here to my library package references. I'm going to go online, and I'm going to search for AutoFac. I'm going to install it. Great. So it's now gone ahead and done the work for me of hooking up AutoFac to be referenced within my project so that I can use it. But now I've got to configure AutoFac itself. So for that, I have a nice little snippet, which is not working. There we go. So none of this is web API code. This is just how I configure my AutoFac container to tell it to use my contact repository and to use my contact resource so that it can do the buildup of creating that contact repository and throwing it in. And if I can do that, that's going to help me with my unit testing, because in a unit test, I can now mock that repository. I don't have to pass in the real one. I don't have to have my service talking to a fake database. So the next question is, how do we actually allow you to now wire that up? And I talked about simplicity before, and this is something we've really been putting a lot of attention in. So I want to show you what it looks like. It's actually quite nice. So what you do if you want to set up your own things, is you just need this little configuration file, and you just copy that in and paste it in, and it's got some really cool settings on it. First, what's great is, like, if you're in the enterprise, it actually prompts you, are you sure? It's just a way of making sure that you've done that extra check before you actually go and deploy. Okay, I'm kidding. We're not going to do that to you. So what we're doing is, and looking at some of the great stuff that the web platforms team has been doing with MVC, et cetera, is we're saying, okay, what I really want to do is find a way to configure things nicely in code. I just saw that I could do that with AutoFac. I saw that I was able to create those routes. Can I do that for something like plugging in an IOC? And the answer is, yes, you can. So what we're going to do is we have this new class, which is called a HTTP host configuration builder. No, am I doing that wrong? HTTP, what am I doing wrong there? There we go. Yes, okay. And what this does is it actually supports a Fluent API. And as a matter of fact, you don't have to new it up. What you can do is you can do this HTTP host configuration builder. That's why I wasn't finding it. And it has on it, you have this create method. What a Fluent API does is it guides me. What are the kinds of things that I can do from this point on? In this case, I want to be able to register an IOC container, which we've actually calling here a resource factory. But it's right there for me to find that information from IntelliSense. I can go now and I can register my resource factory. And I see that I can either pass it an instance of iResource Factory, or I can just inline a Lambda expression, which is what I'm going to do. So that Lambda expression takes three parameters. So it's going to take a type, an instance, context, and a message. And then once I have that, I can go to my container, and I can do a resolve, and I can pass it the T. And the second thing it has is an action, which we'll just leave as empty. Now I can take that and I can actually pass it in at the time when I am configuring my routes. And if I add additional routes, I can keep using that config class. So I don't have to specify that information, that configuration information over and over again. And I don't have to put it within a config file. Once I've done that, if everything has worked correctly, I should be able to put a breakpoint here. Let's see. Takes two parameters. Okay. There we go. So there you go. I was able to plug in AutoFac. I got my repository plugged in. That now means if I want to, I'm able to now unit test the capabilities that I have here. So let's see that working. So I'm going to go create a new test project. And we'll just call it Contact Manager Tests. I'm going to add a reference back to my Contact Manager. I'm just going to whack this. Annoying stuff. Oh, I need my class. That's right. So we'll just public class, contacts, tests. Now, one of the things I'm going to need here is I'm going to use a mocking framework. And in this case, I'm going to use mock. And that's because I want to mock my repository. That was the whole reason why I've gotten that injected. So I'm going to go add a library reference. And I'm going to find mock. There's many different mocking frameworks that you can use. I'm just choosing to use this one. It's going to download it, install it, NuGet goodness. And now this should all work. And if we take a look at these tests, I'm mocking up my contact repository, and I want to check to see that the contacts get returned. Or I'm posting a contact, and I'm seeing that the contact gets added. Those are very simple tests. Let's run them. Define the assembly is not referenced. Okay, we need a reference. We will just add a bunch of references for our web API stuff. So we'll go to our contact manager. We'll add these. Okay, that should compile now. Oh, there's one more binary missing, which is our net HTTP. That's our client library. Let's try again. Okay, build succeeded. Let's run our tests. No test found in the file because I didn't put a test class attribute. Try that again. Okay. Oop, one failed. First one passed. Why did the second one fail? Resource post. It is contact. Contact equals new contact. Resource.post. Say that again. From the contact itself? Ah. Very good. Thank you. Well, we see that our unit tests work. No, it's still not working. Why is it not working? Let's try one more time. Let me rebuild, maybe. Oh, I need to rebuild, most likely. Let me just double check and see that it actually did it. Post, repository.post, contact. Yeah, that looks good. Let's rebuild all. Let's come here. Let's just run this one. See if this runs. Yes, it worked. Okay, but that's not really touching on some of that HTTP richness that we talked about. I said that you can actually validate that it's working with HTTP the way it should. So let's try another one. We saw how I was able to change the status code to a 201. I want to be able to validate that in a unit test. And in this case, now I want to be able to actually work with those response messages. So we can see here that when I'm calling the post, I'm just getting back that response, and I'm able to just do a simple assert. I'm not having to host anything special. Let's run that test and see if that works. Okay, so if we zoom in there, we can see that we got success on status being set to created. So you can go further with this and just imagine that any of the stuff that you want to be able to test, combining with the support for working with an IOC container and our new HTTP request, HTTP response message, all that stuff is testable. We also saw that we were able to achieve that without having to go through a lot of pain. I didn't have to change all my code to suddenly say, now I want to introduce an IOC container, as an example. And that's what we think simplicity is about. It's allowing you to get off the ground really simply, and you notice I didn't have to use that IOC, I didn't have to use that configuration class, but when the time came that I needed to do something, it was very easy for me to do it. We also saw that we were able to work with some of the great stuff that the community is doing out there, such as IOC containers, mocking frameworks, etc. We didn't force you to use the Microsoft answer. We allowed you to pick and choose and to integrate those pieces well with Web API. But let's talk a bit about flexibility, because that's the basic out-of-the-box type scenario, which we've worked hard to make that easy. But what if I want to change things? Like, for example, there's this great JSON serializer out there called JSON.net. Anybody here heard of JSON.net? Newtonsoft JSON? Newtonsoft JSON is a really nice JSON serializer. I can imagine that currently it's not using Newtonsoft. No, it's not. But what if I wanted to? Could I? Wouldn't that be great if I could just go and find something that the community's done that works the way I want it to and just plug that in and use that for my JSON serializer rather than using the Microsoft version? Well, if you want to do that, you actually can do that, and I'm going to show you how. So the first thing we're going to do is go get another NuGet package. We're going to search for Newtonsoft, which is the JSON.net package. Let's try JSON and see what comes back. There we go. I'm going to install that. So what we want to allow you to do with Web API is say that any kind of format that you would like to use, you can support it. And we're going to see a bunch of those in about 5 minutes. But even if you don't like the default ones that we've used and you want to replace them, you can replace them. And that's what I'm going to do with Newtonsoft's serializer. So in my project, I'm going to go and I'm going to add a new class. And I'm just going to call it JSON Formatter. Now, in WCF, we're introducing a new type called a media type formatter. Media type formatters are your way of saying to WCF, I want you to support a specific media type. And there are many out there which we're going to get into, like I said, within a couple of minutes. But in this case, what I want to do is I want to replace the default one for JSON, which JSON standardly is represented as two media types, application/JSON, text/JSON. So let's get that to work first. So when I create a formatter, I have this supported media types collection. So I'm going to add support for application/JSON. And I'm going to add support for text/JSON. Great. Now I'm getting an error here because this is an abstract class. There's some things I have to implement. I'm going to implement those. And we can see that I get two methods, one called onReadFromStream, one called onWriteToStream. And what those are a way of doing is it allows us to hand you the model that's being returned or incoming, the message that's incoming, and it gives you the flexibility to say, I'll figure it out. I'll figure out a way to get that HTTP traffic that's coming in and turn it into a JSON object, or I will figure out how to take an object that's coming back and to represent that as JSON. So none of this, again, is WCF code, as far as what you just saw me write in that on read from stream. It's newing up the JSON serializer, newing up a stream reader, and then it's using the JSON text reader to do the deserialization. On the right side, I'm going to do the reverse. New up the JSON serializer, take the instance, turn it into JSON. Great. Now I have to tell WCF to use my serializer and not use the serializer that's in the box. So one of the things you'll notice if you look at our Fluent API here is there's another method called set operation handler factory. And what this operation handler factory does allow me to do a couple of things. But one of the things it allows me to do is to specify formatters. We have an easier way to specify formatters, but in this case, I want to swap the existing one. So the way we do that is we write this factory class, which I'm going to do now. Why is it doing that? So I'm going to create, let's call it my handler factory. And it's going to inherit HTTP operation handler factory. Then in the constructor, I have access to formatters. So if I want to, I could clear the collection. If I clear the collection, though, that's going to be bad, because what's going to happen is I'm going to get rid of support for XML and form URL encoding. I don't want to do that. But when we give you formatters, we give you a list. So because it's a list, I can insert myself higher at the beginning of the list before our default JSON serializer, which then becomes no op. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to use the lists insert method. I'm going to put it at an index of 1, and I'm going to new up my JSON formatter. Once I've done that, I can come here and just set my factory. So again, I didn't have to go into my configuration or muck with it or anything like that. Now if I come into my formatter and put some breakpoints there and run the app, there's my repository getting created. There we go. You can see that I'm in the JSON formatter. So I just went and replaced the default formatter that we use in the box to use JSON.NET. And that's just the beginning. It means you have the full flexibility to go and use whatever's out there or write your own to provide your own capabilities or service your own requirements. And I would argue that you didn't have to go through a lot of pain to do that. I mean, again, pointing out that in this particular class right here, which is my JSON formatter, the only code that's really WCF specific is this registering of these media types, which I want to do because I need to tell WCF these are the things you need to worry about. That's flexibility, we think. It's not in your face, but it's easy to do what you want to do when you want to do it. I love this because when I saw this flexible flyer picture, it says there, it says, new all-steel front acts as a shock absorber, prevents seats and rails from splitting. And I thought about shock absorber and said, you know, yeah, I've worked with lots of frameworks where it was really easy to get going, But as soon as I had to do something that was not part of the standard, I suddenly was shock and awe, like, oh my God, are you serious? That's what I have to do. We even built a few of those. You won't get that experience with Web API. And you'll be able to really unleash your inner artist, utilizing all the stuff that's out there to really deliver good solutions. Let's talk a bit about formats. So we've just shown a few. We've really literally only shown three. We've shown XML, we've shown JSON, and we've shown form URL encoding. Is that the only format that matters? Those three? There's tons of formats out there. If you look at this slide, there's some that you might know. Text HTML, the browser, that's actually a media type. When we say format, we're really talking about media types. Multi-part form data, that's the way if I'm going to send a form and send files, I have to be able to do form URL, multi-part encoding. There's SVG. SVG offers a great graphical experience. All of these are completely different formats. And as a matter of fact, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I actually went on the IANA website. There's this website called IANA. IANA is the Internet Naming Authority. And when you go to IANA, you see this directory of media types. Lots of different media types that are out there. One that's very popular, which you can see right very prominently, is this one over here, Atom plus XML. I'm sure you guys have heard of that. If you're using a feed reader, you're using Atom. So if I can have my services returning things in Atom, they're naturally going to be able to work with other types of clients than just browsers. Now, when I saw this list, I decided to start scrolling just to get an idea of how many media types there are. Because you might think, oh, that's just this, you know, there's just that set. There's actually a lot of them. There's 900 different media types just in the application namespace or the application branch of IANA. Ah! No, we can actually relax. You don't have to be scared. You don't have to know, you don't have to support all these different 900 or there's thousands of media types that are out there. But the benefit is that if you have a customer or a client, and when I mean client, I don't mean the client that pays you. I mean the thing they use to access your capabilities that understands specific types of media types like Atom, then you want to be able to support that because you're going to have a richer experience. You're going to offer a richer experience to that customer. One particular format that we've been very focused on is the OData protocol, which is really using Atom. And OData provides a way to query data, but do it in a way that's friendly over HTTP. One of many different formats that are out there. Well, in Web API, we're actually going to allow you to support OData out of the box. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to switch to another solution. This solution is actually using a bunch of different formatters. We're going to look at those. The first one we're going to look at is OData. As I mentioned, OData gives me that queryability. Well, that would be great then if I could take my contact management application and expose it so it can be queried. But there's two parts to OData. OData has a representation format, which is really built off of Atom or JSON. They support other formats in the future. Those are the primary ones you see today. And then there's the URI format, which allows you to actually do queries. Well, with WCF Web API, we're actually going to support both. You'll be able to return things in OData, and you'll be able to use the OData query format. So if we look now at my contacts resource, we can see that on the get method, it's actually returning an iQueryable of contact. It's not returning a list of contact. When I return that iQueryable of contact, I say to WCF that I want you, Web API, to understand the OData URI format. So let me show you how that works. So if I go here to my contacts, okay, I just got back some XML. What I can do is specify that I want that in OData. And now you can see that I'm getting back OData. But what I really want to do is also support that query capability. So now what I'm going to do to my URI is I'm going to use the OData query format to specify that I want to get back the top one. Nope, I did F5. That's not what I wanted to do. So let's do top equals one. And now I see that I got back one contact. Querying, though, is actually beneficial for a lot of different formats, not just OData. So what we're allowing you to do in Web API is say that any representation that you can return can also have an OData query URI syntax supported. So whether it's JSON, XML, or any other kind of representation that's out there, I can use OData to get to that information. Now, up until this point, we've only looked at markup. I mean, the primary thing that we've been returning is XML, JSON. You could even argue that with OData, well, that's just XML. I could probably bend the serializer somehow today to support that. But a representation on the web can be anything in HTTP. For example, it could be an image. So here I'm going to go and say contact/1. I'm going to get back a contact. But I can also say contact/1/PNG, and now I get back an image. Completely different representation. It's not just a serialization mechanism. HTTP representations can be anything you want. So how do we make that work in Web API? How does that image actually work? That's my Xbox avatar, by the way. And then we have some other avatars of other people on our team. Now, just to show you that this is not some trick and it's really accessing the same exact code, I'm going to put a breakpoint here. Why is that not working? Okay. Actually, I'm not using that one. That one is accessing the contact resource. And I'm going to put a breakpoint on the get. So if I go to contact/4, we hit our breakpoint. So what you're seeing here is we've separated out the concerns. I can have my resource return a model, in this case, return a contact. I can arbitrarily hook up whatever formats I want to. That means that if my customer requirements change, if my customer says, hey, we want to be able to return it in SVG, I can write a custom formatter for doing that and plugging that in without having to touch my code, without having to touch my resource code. It just returns a model. We do the right thing based on either the URI or the headers that are coming in to select the correct representation. And if I jump back to my global.asax, you can see that I've also registered a contact PNG formatter. And if we dive into that, similar to the JSON formatter, this gets a chance to write to a stream. In this case, I know that it's a contact. I know that I've plugged this in particular, on resources that support contacts. And when you write the formatter, you actually have the ability to implement a method called onCanReadType and onCanWriteType. So if I want to say that this particular formatter for images only works for contacts, I can go in the onCanWriteType. Sorry, onCanReadType. No, is that onCanWrite? That's onCanWriteType. I can go into the onCanWriteType and put in a check that says, is the type contact? So I can add this globally in my system, but still have logic that says this only applies if the thing that's coming in is a contact or maybe derives from contact. Again, getting that flexibility. I don't have to do it. I can do it if I need to. That's a really interesting format, the image. And you could imagine something like, I have a contact system and I want to have a more detailed image, or maybe a PDF that is a resume of the contact. And I can plug in these different formatters for supporting that experience. But there are other types of formats that are even more interesting. And in this case, I'm working with contacts. And it turns out there actually is an electronic representation of a business card that's out there. It's called vCard. What vCard allows me to do is there are systems that understand vCard. So if I can represent my contacts as a vCard, those systems can just pull them in. It doesn't force the customer to do any kind of mapping or anything special. It just works. XML or JSON simply says to a client, I'm parsable. It doesn't give rich semantics. The client has to know that. It has to know that this XML that I got back works in this very specific way. I can't just walk up to any system and pass it that XML and it will know what to do with it. But I can walk up to any system that understands vCard and it will know what to do with it. And so here I've plugged in a vCard formatter. Did I change anything? What happened there? That's interesting. Okay, I got scared there. They're broke for a second. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my URL here and go back into Fiddler, go to my request builder, put my contacts, and in this case, I'm going to use the accept header of text/directory, which you saw on that other slide. Nope. Did I? Nope. See what I did there. Did I specify it wrong? Contact vCard formatter text/directory. Let's try that again. Let's try this instead. That's a vCard. So it's not markup. It's more of a text format, kind of like YAML, though it's not YAML. Guess who understands that? Gmail. That means if I can take that information and pass it to Gmail, I can have a rich interaction with this application here and have it just pull my contacts in. And let's see that work. So I'm going to gmail.com. You can see that I'm logged in and I have this contacts page. And on that contacts page, I have this option to import contacts. So look what it says. vCard. It already understands vCard. Little known fact is, when I go to this dialog and browse it, I can actually put in a URI. Now, I mentioned with OData, with our support for OData, that I can use that OData URI format even if the result that's coming back is not OData. In this case, it's vCard. So let's try that. Let's do a top query to take the top three. Let me just do one thing. There's an exception that sometimes gets thrown here, but it's only when you're running in debug mode. The reason why this exception is going to come, I'm being preemptive on it, is because the file system doesn't actually know it's talking over HTTP, but it does have some support for what's called this thing called WebDev, which ends up doing multiple requests. But let's just put this URI in, hit open. We'll see if we get our exception or not. Okay, so didn't blow up. It says also add these imported contacts to, and let's just add it to my contacts. Let's click import. There you go. So it was able to pull in my contact information, in this case, my first name, email, etc. So I had a rich interaction. That application was acting kind of like a mashup, and it was pulling down functionality from my web API and pushing that into Gmail. And it was able to do that through this rich support for formats. That's not the only format, though, that's out there. As I mentioned, there's tons of different formats that you can work with. And there's lots of interesting things you can do with these formats beyond just providing a way to pipe information from system to system. If you come to my talk tomorrow on REST with Web API, we'll talk about this great idea of building systems that use distributed workflows that work over HTTP that can independently evolve, where you can have the old versions of the system and the new versions of the system from a client perspective running side by side. And you can introduce new functionality without breaking those clients. And these are the kind of things that Comcast and Best Buy are interested in. And I will be talking more about that tomorrow. The very last thing I want to show is where can you get this? We've been building Web API now for about a year, and at PDC we announced that we were going to make it available on CodePlex. You can go to wcf.codeplex.com today and get these bits. They're still in development. They work on top of .NET 4.0. And you can go to NuGet and do webapi.all, and you can start to just develop with those bits. So I realize I went over on time. I want to thank you all for your patience. If you have any questions, I will hang around and look forward to talking with you, and have a great conference. My name is Glenn Block. Thank you very much.